I've been sleeping a little bit. I've already put up the blackboard with the three basic information. I'll come back with the observational constraints later with the bell feature. And for now, I just refer to that, which is an overview of my talk. First of all, let me say that I will talk only about current star formation and the different stars, particularly in the solar, and I think in the neighborhood of the solar, of the sun, of the solar system. There will be another of these talks by Romano about primordial star formation, the very first star that formed in the universe. I will not touch on that subject in this talk. First of all, why is star formation so crucial for us in physics? Why are we so interested in star formation? The main reason is that stars have a very important, many important effects on the evolution of galaxies. They produce the heavy elements that enrich the interstellar medium of galaxies. They are very important energy sources for the interstellar medium of galaxies as well. Through various mechanisms, ionization, explosion of supernovae, and stellar winds, and a number of mechanisms. They are also responsible, the first stars that appeared in the universe, they are probably responsible for reuniting the universe as well. And then if you're interested in planet formation, it's possible that you will not be able to understand correctly the initial conditions to understand the formation of planets in circumstellar disks, unless you understand correctly how stars are formed. I want to start by defining what the theoretical problem is. We know that there is a lot of gas in galaxies, and hence it comes in many forms. Some gas is hot, some gas is colder, it comes in a range of densities. But we also know that stars are always formed, always originate from the densest and coldest gas. And so, the problem really is that of understanding how. A gas and a cloud of cold gas will turn into stars.
And so this is really the problem we're trying to solve as theoreticians. There is a cloud of cold gas. We call it dark clouds, or sometimes we call them molecular clouds because they're formed mainly by of molecular. They're made primarily of molecular hydrogen. And so, especially if you know the average physical properties of these clouds, for example, the average temperature, the average density, the RMS velocity, dispersion inside the clouds, and maybe the magnetic field strength, then from these average properties, you should be able to predict the formation of stars. And what does that mean? It means that you know you want to be able to predict the rate at which stars are formed, so the star formation rate, the rate at which the gas is converted into stars, and also the mass distribution of star, or mass function. And we also call it initial mass function in astronomy for various reasons. And you want to know the mass distribution of stars because massive stars are very different from low mass stars. For example, they explode in supernovae, they have a very different effect. They reach the interstellar medium with metals much more than low mass stars. So that's the problem. And so how do we address this problem? We know that the density inside stars is of order a gram per cubic centimeter, but the density in the interstellar medium of galaxies is only a particle per cubic centimeter. So there's a huge range of densities. How do you go from the density of the interstellar medium to the density of stars? Clearly, because stars are bound by gravity, by their own self-gravity, it's clear that at some point, at some stage, the gravitational collapse has to play a role. So the first thing we need to do is to understand the basic physics of gravitational collapse. And since a lot of people here are not astronomers, I assume that you don't know anything about star formation or even not much about gravitational collapse. And I'll very briefly review that. The first thing to consider is just the effect of gravity. So you, this gas, imagine that this gas cloud, for example, is very cold. So internal pressure doesn't even play a role, only gravity. Then you know that because of the effect of gravity, this cloud will have to collapse in what we call a free fall time. You can easily derive the free fall time. The interesting thing is that the free fall time does not depend on how big the cloud is or how massive. It only depends, or independently, it only depends on the mean density. For example, for a uniform sphere, you find that the free fall time is the square root of the square root of 3 pi over 32 g rho, where rho is the mean density. And so it scales like 1 over the square root of density. The denser, the faster it collapses because gravity is stronger, essentially. However, if this cloud is not that cold, you could, in principle, support it against the collapse by internal pressure, pressure support. So you really have to study the competition between the pressure, the support from internal pressure, and the force of gravity that tends to cause the collapse. And a simple argument to define the stability condition is that, if you think about it, is that the sound crossing time has to be shorter than the freefall time, because then you can avoid a collapse. And so, roughly speaking, you can take the radius divided by some thermal velocity dispersion or speeds or sound speed, and if that is less or equal than the freefall time, the clouds doesn't have to, could be stable, it won't collapse, it will maybe oscillate. More formally, what you can do is to do a linear stability analysis. You take an infinite medium with a uniform temperature, uniform density, static, no velocity, no magnetic field, and you do a linear perturbation analysis where you start with the linear density perturbation. And this analysis was done by Jeans long ago in 1902. Okay? And what he found is there is a dispersion relation such that density perturbation above a certain size will collapse, will be unstable and will collapse. And that size, we call it Jeans length, and you find that it is the square root of, don't expect me to remember any formula, pi sigma thermal square divided by g rho zero. Rope? Yes. And then you can also, so if the density perturbation is larger than this size, then the perturbation will collapse. And then you can define a mass. You can define a mass that we call the Jeans mass, which is simply the volume for 4 pi r cube. Instead of r is lambda Jeans cube, and maybe lambda Jeans divided by 2 cube, if you want to consider the radius. You can define in different ways, and the density. And you find that this scales like the mean density to the minus 1 half times the temperature to the 3 half. Now, if the medium is truly isothermal, you can consider the temperature as a constant, as it is for dark clouds. And what you learn from here is that as your clouds start to collapse, if the temperature does not increase, the density is increasing, and so the critical mass for collapse decreases. So during the collapse of the system, you can have smaller and smaller density perturbation that can collapse. Okay, so we have learned the basic physics of gravitational instability. Now, have we learned enough to really predict what is the outcome? For example, what is the most common stellar mass that you expect, given these initial conditions? And if you think about it, the question is no at all, because the outcome of this process is completely dependent, like in cosmology, on the initial density perturbation, the statistics of those initial density perturbations. In other words, what kind of size of perturbation is available in the initial conditions. And if, for example, you make the hypothesis that you have density perturbations of arbitrarily small size available in the initial conditions. Then, as the cloud collapses, you will have smaller and smaller objects that are able to collapse because the Jeans mass keeps dropping down until the density becomes so large that the gas is opaque to radiation, and the heat that is liberated by the gravitational contraction, the potential energy that goes into heat, is not able to radiate fast enough, the temperature starts to increase, and you kind of fragment below that density, above that density, or below the corresponding Jeans mass anymore. So this was proposed, this mechanism of so-called gravitational fragmentation was proposed by Hoyle, also long ago, until 1953. And the mass, the so-called opacity limit, this is called opacity limit, limited gravitational fragmentation. And the smallest mass that you get from this argument is something, mass mean, is something of the order of maybe 1% of the solar mass. This symbol here means sun, and the sun, the mass of the sun is 2×10³ gram. So the smallest mass you can form here is 1%, and perhaps even 1,000th of the mass of our sun. And I'll come back to this later, but the typical, the most common stellar mass is 2/10 of the mass of the sun. So clearly this mass is too small. So certainly gravitational fragmentation, at least explained in this by this argument, is not an answer to the star, to the original stars, and actually it's worse than that. We know that star-forming clouds are not collapsing as a whole, and we know that they don't turn into stars. They don't turn all their mass into stars in a freefall time. So, which will be the result of this mechanism. And so clearly, this is not enough. What we've learned so far is not enough to understand star formation. Okay. Next, you could add a little bit of complexity here. We know that the interstellar medium is magnetized, so you could imagine that there is also a magnetic field. And then you could ask what would be the condition of stability where you compare magnetic energy with gravitational energy instead of thermal energy. And this is you can actually do the exercise. You can just plug the numbers here, and so the magnetic energy would be d squared over 8 pi times a volume. So you could write or third pi r cube. And on the other side, we put, we're considering uniform sphere as usual. So for a uniform sphere, the gravitational energy would be 3/5 gm squared over r. And you just do a little algebra, and you find that, so in other words, if gravity is stronger than magnetic energy, you think that you may have collapsed. You don't have magnetic support. And if you do the algebra, you find that the largest mass that you can support with that magnetic field is of the order 0.17 times the magnetic flux, B r squared, divided by g to the 1/2, g to the 1/2. Or in other words, there is a critical value of the mass to flux ratio, mass to magnetic flux ratio, which is 0.17 divided the square root of the gravitational constant. And that's interesting. And you can actually rewrite this as a re-express this critical mass as a function of magnetic field and density, which is a little bit more useful for some applications. And what you find is something of the order of 1,000 times the mass of the sun for a mean density which is perhaps typical on some scale of molecular of dark clouds or star-forming clouds, 10^3 particle per cubic centimeter to the minus 2. And it goes with the magnetic field to the third power, and this is in units of 10 micrograms, which is again some reasonable value for star forming clouds. So you could think, well, maybe this is what determines stellar masses. And well, this number is a little large. You can make it smaller by playing with these parameters, and you see there's quite a bit of uncertainty because this is not well defined. The magnetic field strength is hard to measure, cubic root dependence, square dependence. So, but the most important thing here is that most likely, this magnetic critical mass does not define a typical stellar mass because the magnetic field, once you put together a dense region that is trying to collapse against the support of the magnetic field, even if it is stable, the magnetic field may very rapidly diffuse away, diffuse out of the cloud, and then the star, and then that region will become unstable. So this doesn't really define very well a threshold for star formation. The reason for that is that the reason why the magnetic field can diffuse out rather rapidly is because of ambipolar drift. And the fact is that I didn't write anywhere, the fractional ionization, the ratio of ions or electrons over neutrals in molecular cloud, is of the order of 10 to the minus 7. Molecular clouds are basically neutral. However, you could roughly speaking say that the magnetic field is frozen in the gas, but only to a certain level of approximations. In reality, you're going to have ambipolar drift. In other words, the magnetic field is coupled to the ions, but it's only indirectly coupled to the neutrals through ion-neutral collision, through friction. And so there is a time scale that you can evaluate for ambipolar drift. And so, in other words, I don't think, personally at least, that the magnetic critical mass then is probably the answer to, gives us an answer to what the typical mass should be. And so we're still not able to understand star formation at this level. So what comes next? What comes next is that if you really want to understand a complex problem like star formation, even if you are a hardcore theoretician, you're still better off by looking at the observations or in other fields, at the experiments. Because otherwise the possibilities are infinite. While if you look at the observations in details, then you know what is the parameter space, you know what the observational constraints are, and you are inspired also. You build your physical intuition on the observation. So to move a little faster, I actually listed here already the main observational properties. And first I listed the outcome of the process and then the initial conditions, the condition in the environment that where the stars originate. So what do we know about stars? Well, first of all, we know that there is a most common mass, roughly speaking, around 0.2 solar masses. And what you see here is this curve here is the mass distribution of stars. This is the log of the number of stars versus the log of their mass. And there is a most common mass here around 0.2 solar masses. Yes, so that's exactly why we call this initial mass function. So in other words, we have learned about this curve by observing very young clusters of stars, where we don't think there's been much dynamical evolution yet, or the massive stars are not evolved yet. But we also know that above a solar mass, roughly, there is a parallel mass distribution, which is drawn here. And then below the typical mass, of course, there is some kind of cutoff. We also know that stars tend to be specially clustered, and it's very common even to form binaries. But then the other important thing is that the efficiency of the process is low. If you define it like the mass in stars divided by the total mass of the system, it's roughly 1%. So it's an inefficient process of turning gas into stars. property of clouds, gas clouds, called gas clouds where stars are formed, are not so trivial to define, because in reality the interstellar medium, even the cold interstellar, especially the cold interstellar medium of galaxies where stars are formed, is like a continuum with a hierarchy of scales, and on each scale we find so with a hierarchy of scale, when you observe a certain region, you may be able to define a cloud, but then you reobserve it with a higher resolution and you find it is broken into 10 pieces. And you go into each of those pieces with an even higher resolution and it's still broken into smaller pieces. And so it's very difficult in this hierarchical structure to define a star formation unit. But roughly speaking, there are giant molecular, what we call giant molecular clouds, that we could consider like the large scale star formation units. And again, there is a number of sizes and the number of values of physical parameters, but here I give you an example which may be typical. So when we can define a large molecular cloud as an object with roughly 1 million solar masses, the temperature is of the order of 10 Kelvin, the density could be anything between 100 or 1,000 particles per cubic centimeter. And again, this is an example. There are smaller clouds that are denser, bigger clouds that are, have lower density, although the temperature in the cold phase is roughly 10 K. And so the size of this cloud is about 10 parsec. When we say parsec, we mean 3 to 10 to the 18 centimeters. So the typical size of a cloud is 3 times to the 19 centimeters in this case. In this object, the typical genes mass is of the order of 3 solar masses. So well, the typical stellar mass is much smaller, so again, this is not enough of an argument. This doesn't really give us a correct prediction for the stellar mass. As I said before, it's an insufficient argument, an insufficient scenario. As I said before, these large clouds, even if they contain almost 1 million genes masses, they should be highly unstable, they don't collapse as a whole. And they therefore, we know that they don't. The star formation rate, the rate at which the gas is turned into star, must be much smaller than the total mass of the cloud divided by the threefold time, because they evolve on a longer time scale than that. And they are pretty messy. We know from observations that their density field is has a very strong density contrast, very large density fluctuations, and we're talking of orders of magnitudes density fluctuations. The morphology is very filamentary, and the magnetic field is hard to measure, but we know that it varies. It has large variations, and it even seems to be scaling with density. So larger region of larger density have a larger magnetic field strength, and the dependence is roughly like the square root of density, of gas density. Then we also observe everywhere in interstellar cloud supersonic random velocities. The kinetic energy of these random velocities is in excess or comparable to the gravitational energy of these clouds, and they're both much larger than the thermal energy. So these motions are, as I said, they're highly supersonic, and the magnetic energy, there is a debate whether the magnetic energy is of the order of the kinetic and gravitational energy or intermediate between the gravitational and the thermal energy. This is a debate that Åke Nordlund and I had started a few years ago. But I will not go into the details of the debate here. We also know that these random supersonic velocities follow a scaling law that was discovered first by Larson in 1981. So the velocity scale, the velocity differences between two points at a distance L grows as L to the power 0.4, roughly speaking. And this is, of course, and it was suggested by Larson, reminiscent of a turbulent flow, where you have the same type of scaling of velocity with size. Even if Larson had never discovered this velocity-size relation, We knew from very long ago that the Reynolds number of the interstellar medium, which measure the importance of essentially inertia over viscosity, typical velocity, typical size of the system divided by the viscosity, is of the order of 10 to the 8 in interstellar cloud. But there is no doubt that the observed large-scale motions in molecular cloud must cascade down into a turbulent cascade, must break into smaller velocity, into smaller velocity fluctuations on smaller and smaller scales, all the way down to the scale where viscosity becomes important. That's very small, 10 to the 13 centimeter or less in this cloud. Okay, so the question is, we know a lot about the initial conditions, about the physical conditions in these star-forming clouds. How do we go from here to predict this property of stars? And so the next topic is magnetically supported clouds. Why? Because the traditional answer, at least for many years, for how to go from here to here, was that star-forming clouds are magnetically supported. I've already told you a little bit about what it means to be magnetically supported. What it means for a cloud of this size is that the average magnetic field strength has to be something like 30 to 60 microgauss, or maybe 100 microgauss, depending on the type of clouds that you're considering. And if that is the case, because you're assuming that the clouds are supported by the magnetic field, they're not free-falling. They don't evolve in a free-fall time. But remember the process of ambipolar drift. I said on small scale it may be rather fast, but on the scale of this cloud, say 10 parsec, large clouds, the time of ambipolar drift is of the order of 10 times the freefall time. So the ambipolar drift time is roughly 10 freefall time. So the idea is that clouds, therefore, if they are magnetically supported, they will be evolving quasi-statically for a rather long time, of the order of 10 freefall times. And that directly solves the problem of why the star formation rate is low, because the typical timescale is not a freefall time, it's much longer than that. From this point of view, the observed random velocities are interpreted essentially as Alphen waves, because if the cloud is supported by the magnetic field, then the magnetic energy is comparable to the gravitational energy, but we also know that the gravitational energy is comparable to the kinetic energy, and so the RMS velocities then are of the order of the Alphen velocity, which is the magnetic field over the square root of 4 pi rho. And so you can say that you have a natural explanation for the reason why we observe random velocities that have this intensity, because the field strength is such that the Alphen speed is of the order of those velocities under this assumption. Okay, one criticism with this picture is that if you're really saying that clouds are evolving quasi-statically, that sounds a little bit at odds with the observations that clouds are actually already highly nonlinear systems that are really strongly fragmented already in their density field even before they form stars. And it's not clear also that you can interpret the observed supersonic random velocities as MHT waves only, simply. However, independently of this criticism, the most important thing is that this scenario, this assumption, still doesn't tell us much, doesn't offer a prediction for the origin of the stellar mass distribution. And that's really what I'm after from the very beginning of this talk. What sets the typical stellar mass, or the mass distribution, given the initial parameters? Yes?
Is this story pretty much independent of
the angular momentum of the clouds is extremely low, and even when you look at a smaller, denser region inside clouds, the typical rotation velocity of protostellar cores, we call them, is of the order of the speed of sound. It's very small. However, when this object when a cloud tries to collapse to form a star, it has, in order to become a star, in order to reach the crazy density of stars, it has to liberate an enormous amount of angular momentum. So historically, in the field of star formation, there is a so-called angular momentum problem, which has been addressed in many ways. When you fragment into two pieces, some of the angular momentum goes into orbital momentum. There is magnetic braking, because the protostars, as it collapses, drags in a magnetic field, which can shed angular momentum outwards. And there are magnetic torques also, gravitational torques, because there is a disk, perhaps with spirals around the collapsing object. So there are many ways to shed angular momentum, and I don't. That's for me like more of a problem of how to create a single stars. But here I want to tell you about the problems of predicted star formation in general, meaning the star formation rate and the mass distribution of stars, assuming that an object that starts to collapse can indeed collapse into a star. Yeah, feel free to interrupt me anytime you need it. So, as I said, we are after a scenario that offers us an explanation for the origin of the mass distribution, not only of the star formation rate, but why the star formation is inefficient. And so the next chapter I want to discuss is what we call turbulent fragmentation. In other words, the traditional picture that says that star-forming clouds are magnetically supported really focuses much more on the role of the magnetic field, which is fine. It's interesting physics, but you cannot really you cannot neglect the role of the kinetic energy, because as I said, it is much in excess of the thermal energy, and it's comparable or sometimes in excess of the gravitational energy. So if you want a theory of star formation that works, that is realistic, you cannot neglect the kinetic energy. In other words, you cannot neglect the presence of turbulence. Turbulence is really ubiquitous in star-forming clouds. So turbulent fragmentation indeed focuses on the role of turbulence. And now you have a problem, because as you all know very well, there is no general theory for turbulence. So now you may think that if you need to understand turbulence to understand star formation, you have no hope to understand star formation. And in fact, this is not even the usual incompressible turbulence. This is supersonic magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. So it's even a worse beast than the traditional one. Well, in reality, we don't need a general theory of turbulence, and we don't even know what a general theory of turbulence is, which is probably the main reason why we don't have a general theory of turbulence. What we need is really to understand, or in a sense discover, quantify, the statistics of a turbulent flow, which has this property, and supersonic, is magnetized. And then you can do today, and we've done it, with large numerical simulations. And then the beauty of all this is that the statistics of turbulence are universal flow properties. So now you can hope to use, therefore, these universal statistics to build a statistical theory of large-scale star formation. And so suddenly you realize that turbulence is actually a powerful tool rather than being an unwanted complication. And that's been our perspective. That has been our approach towards the problem of turbulence. So we're really focused on trying to understand the turbulence. But I will not describe what we have done in numerical simulations. And I will try to now show you how what you expect, what the prediction will be from the point of view of turbulent fragmentation, without going into any details of simulations or even not much theory. So now we know that this cloud, now we do not neglect the fact that this cloud has random velocity in all directions. It's a total mess. The density field is broken into pieces already. And that's understandable, because if you have supersonic random velocities, we actually know that the equation of state is roughly exothermal. So you have a very strong exothermal shock all over the place, a very complicated network of crisscrossing shocks. The density contrast, of course, will be huge, and of course you will get filamentary structure. So the fact that the density field is the way it is a natural consequence of the velocity field being what it is. But now, how do you predict what would be the typical stellar mass that comes out of this mess, or even the distribution of stellar masses or the star formation rate. It's a very difficult problem, much more difficult than predicting a mass distribution in cosmology, where you start from linear density perturbation. And so I give you now the qualitative way of going, of trying to understand this process, without any numerical simulation, essentially. The qualitative way is the following. We know that we have to scratch the Jeans mass. It's linear instability analysis. It doesn't really apply to this. The static medium clearly doesn't work. However, there is another way to study the problem of gravitational collapse, the problem of the competition between internal pressure and gravity. And this other way is to consider the hydrostatic equilibrium of an isothermal sphere bound by an external pressure. And this actually was done, again, long ago, in 55 by Bonner, I think, and in 56 by Bonner, and in 55 by Ebert. Although we call the thing Bonner-Ebert, but Bonner did it the year before. Ebert did it the year before. Anyway, what they studied, as I said, is the hydrostatic equilibrium of an isothermal sphere, so constant temperature. This is not a linear setup anymore, because there is also an external pressure. It's not just self-gravity that keeps this bound. There is also an external pressure. And so now you can distinguish between the internal pressure support against gravity and the external pressure that actually wants, in a sense, to squeeze this object together with gravity. And you understand that this is now in a linear setup. You have significant density contrast between the center and the surface. And as I said, you can distinguish between the external pressure and internal pressure. And that's nice, because if you think of a mechanism to put together a dense core that then will have to collapse to become a star, in a sense, you can model that mechanism that puts together this core as some kind of external pressure. And that's, in fact, what I propose to do now. So we can consider these macroscopic motions. We know that the main effect of this macroscopic turbulent motion is that of providing some sort of dynamical pressure. This dynamic pressure due to the turbulence creates continuously density fluctuations. For example, locally you have density fields going like this and like this here, and you're going to create a shock, or you're going to create a post-shock layer, a very dense layer. And inside this layer, we know that this is where stars are going to be formed. A piece of this will become gravitationally unstable if it's dense enough, and you form a star. And so the situation is really where you want to study the stability of objects, of pieces of gas that are, in a sense, bound by external pressure. Only it is dynamical pressure. So what I'm proposing is that we, to keep this as simple as we can, to model the dynamic pressure of the turbulence as an external pressure, to use in the study of this equilibrium. So before I go too far, let me actually show you what Bonner and Ebert found. What they found is that you can define the largest stable mass of this hydrostatic sphere to be stable for a certain external pressure and a certain temperature. And that mass that we call the Bonner-Ebert mass is roughly the thermal velocity dispersion to the fourth power, the gravitational constant to the 3/2, and the dynamic pressure, the external, generally speaking, would be some thermal pressure, the external pressure to the 1/2, I think, I hope. And you can also rewrite this. You write here rho v thermal square, sigma thermal square to the 1/2. And so you get sigma thermal to the third power, g to the 3/2, rho 0 to the 1/2. And you can see that this scales like the Joule's mass. But of course, you're still comparing gravity with pressure, after all. And so the Bonnor, you can find that this is roughly one or two solar masses for a typical density of 10 to the 3 particle per cubic centimeter to the minus 1/2, same dependence as the Joule's mass. And for a temperature, a typical temperature of 10K to the power 3/2. Like the Joule's mass, it's the same story. However, this is, as I said before now, and actually what you find is that the Bonnor-Rieber mass is equal to the Joule's mass divided by 2.47, if you define the Joule's mass like that. And as I said, this is a nonlinear setup. The density in the center for the largest critical mass, the density in the center is roughly 14 times the density at the surface. It's a nonlinear setup. But okay, you say, well, it's identical to the Joule's mass, I've learned nothing. No, because this applies to our problem. Now you have a nonlinear setup where you can specify an external pressure. And what I'm saying is that we are very, very simply modeling the external the turbulent pressure as a dynamic pressure that we plug into this Bonnor-Rieber formula. And so the Bonnor-Rieber that now we call turbulent Bonnor-Rieber mass is going to be, instead of this, we're going to put there the dynamic pressure, which is roughly speaking rho 0 to the 1/2 sigma the velocity of dispersion times the velocity of dispersion. And then you get that, you see, this is equivalent to the standard Bonnor-Rieber mass, sigma thermal to the 3rd power divided by g 3/2 rho 0 1/2. But there is an extra term, which is sigma thermal divided by sigma b. In other words, in the presence of turbulence, the largest stable mass is the traditional Bonnor-Rieber mass for the mean density, for the mean temperature and density, and times the Mach number, the RMS Mach number of the turbulence, the sonic Mach number, to the minus 1. Okay? And so this now is the prediction, and if you put typical numbers, you get, in fact, something that is not too far from 0.2 solar masses. So now, it may be a coincidence, but at least what you learn is that the typical, the most common mass that you predict out of this, because of the effect of the turbulence, of the supersonic turbulence, is of the order of the mass that is observed, the most common mass for stars. This is still not enough because there is a broad range of masses. In fact, basically 4 orders of magnitude, from a percent of a stellar mass to 100 solar masses. From a percent of a solar mass to 100 solar masses. How do you explain that?
What is the characteristic size of this?
Yes, the radius, well, typical number would be that the Bonnor-Rieber radius, which is comparable to the Joule's length, if you put typical density of protostellar cores, would be of the order of 0.1 parsec or so. So 3, 10 to the 17 centimeters.
That's the radius.
Okay, so, and in particular, why is there a power law? Well, that's again the beauty of turbulence. Oh, you know, the turbulence between the large scale where you inject the energy, and then the energy cascades to smaller and smaller scale, and the so-called Kolmogorov dissipation scale, eta, that is the scale where the motions are dissipated by viscosity into heat, if you are within that scale, those two scales, this is the outer scale of the turbulence, then essentially turbulence is a scale-free process.
And then you
the hint that perhaps having a scale-free dynamics has something to do with having a parallel mass distribution. And actually, we tried to work out a simple model where we relate the velocity scaling, the paraspectrum of velocity, or the first-order structure function of velocity in a turbulent, supersonic turbulent flow with the mass distribution under a number of hypotheses. And we are able to retrieve the correct slope of the mass distribution based on the scaling of turbulence. So you can say that this is basically the free scale physics of turbulence. This is the parallel. And as I said, those turbulence statistics are universal flow properties. The paraspectrum of turbulence is not going to change in a region relative to another. And so if that's the explanation for this mass distribution, for this parallel, it's going to have to be roughly the same everywhere. With few exceptions, there are reasons why this could vary, even in this context. The typical mass that you observe is what I've just called the turbulent Bonnet-Rebern mass. Is the fact that it's basically gravitational instability plus turbulent dynamic pressure. But then, if that were the case, you would predict. Oh, by the way, in the interstellar medium, this is of the order of 10 to the 13 centimeter or less, the Kolmogorov dissipation scale. The outer scale of the turbulence, we don't even know how large it is, but it's certainly larger than 100 parsec. And star formation, the typical size of a cloud, let's say several parsec, the typical Bonnet-Rebern radius, 0.1 parsec. So star formation is well within the inertial range of the turbulence, okay? And also, no, that's all I want to say. Finally, if this is all you have a power law that you can even extrapolate from the scaling of turbulence, and then you have a critical mass. Well, then what you would predict is not really that nice curve there. Then what you predict is that the mass distribution of star, log mass and log number, will be a power law, and then a cutoff, which is this mass. Well, clearly it cannot be like that, because if this cutoff is due to the dynamic, to the turbulent pressure, you know that that turbulent pressure has very strong fluctuations in the turbulent flow. So you know that it has to have some kind of distribution. This will be the distribution, the probability of having a certain turbulent Bonnet-Rebern mass. And so you know that it has to have a certain distribution abroad. And so you can relate, essentially, you can try to derive this distribution, again, from the statistics of turbulence. We have done it, for example, from the PDF of gas density in a turbulent flow, simply because we know it from numerical simulation. We also understand it, in principle, why it should be what it is. And if you don't want to know, it is a log normal. The log of the gas density under isothermal condition is a Gaussian in isothermal supersonic turbulence. So we've used that statistics to derive this. And now what happens is that you can say that turbulence would cause a parallel mass distribution of density fluctuations. They're all unstable, they all form stars. But if this is the distribution of your typical, of your critical mass, as soon as you reach this point, you start to have a certain probability that the mass of your density fluctuations is smaller than the Bonnet-Rebern mass, than the critical mass. So the mass distribution has to start to flatten, as it does. And at some point, when you go in this region, there is a small probability that the Bonnet-Rebern mass is this small. Most likely it is larger. And so the probability that you can collapse this object, they're so small, is smaller and smaller. And so you understand the flattening of the curve somewhere in the neighborhood of the solar mass, and then it has to turn over around the typical Bonnet-Rebern mass, turbulent Bonnet-Rebern mass. But of course, this is a gradual process because of the fluctuations in the turbulent flow. And so the last question that you need to answer is why the star formation is a slow process, why it is inefficient. And what you learn in a turbulent flow, in a supersonic turbulent flow, at any given time, you have only a small fraction of the total mass that is inside dense regions where the turbulence has dissipated and that can collapse. Most of the mass is running around in the turbulent flow, and it has a kinetic energy that is too large for those regions to collapse. Okay, so it is natural again in a turbulent flow that the star formation has to be an inefficient process, because only the gas that is found in defines itself in those region of stagnation of the flow after shocks or after intersection of shocks. Only those spots are able to collapse. And well, then you learn that essentially, if what you need is region of stagnation of the flow after the shocks, essentially you form stars wherever the turbulence has dissipated. So this is telling you that from this perspective, the process of star formation is it can be viewed as the process of the dissipation of turbulence in a supersonic turbulent flow, followed by gravitational collapse locally. And then, if you really like to speak in general terms, you know that the dissipation in turbulent flows is very intermittent and clustered in both space and time. And then you would predict, in a sense, that star formation has to be very intermittent and clustered in space and time, which is certainly the case. And again, the approach, what we're really trying to do, I like to repeat again, is to take advantage of the physics of turbulence rather than considering turbulence as a complication, and trying to use those statistics, those universal statistics of turbulent flows, to build a statistical theory of star formation. There are still many, There are still many open issues that we are discussing in the community. And some, for example, but the magnetic field strength is one. How strong is the magnetic field? And that requires an interplay of observations and theory, because the observations, the Zeeman-splitting measurement to determine the field strength in dense clouds, are very difficult. And so they're difficult to interpret because there are very few. And another debate is, what is the star formation rate, really? Because generally speaking, we can say it's a slow process. But really, observationally, we need a this is really an observational program to define much better than we know today what is the star formation rate. And this is also tied to the problem, which is also an open problem, what is the lifetime of these star forming clouds? It's also an observational problem in large part. And also the origin, what is the formation mechanism, because that's also that also enters the problem of the lifetime. And finally, there are two more hotly debated problem. One is, what is the origin of the smallest stars? Because these are really difficult to form. They're really, in my scenario, in this turbulent fragmentation scenario, they are the tail of a distribution. And so, well, if you don't like this scenario, you may argue maybe there are other ways to form these small stars. But they are there. They are a few percent of the mass of the sun, and they are formed everywhere. The other problem is how to form the most massive stars. And here's the problem, is that it's difficult to assemble a lot of mass quickly enough. And and no matter how quickly you do it, you're going to always encounter a situation where, as you try to put that large amount of mass, say 100 solar masses, as you try to put that together, the central object is already shining, is already doing nuclear fusion, and has a very large luminosity. And that luminosity is so strong that by radiation pressure can stop the further accretion of mass into the star. So there is a problem there that has been addressed, if not solved, by the Berkeley group and by other in the past. And the other problem is still that in dense environment, some other groups claim that in dense environment, one way for these objects to grow is by competing for mass. So you can imagine a dense cluster where stars are zooming around, but they're still growing by accretion. They still have gas accreting onto the stars. And some people claim that it is what they call competitive accretion, stars of different mass trying to capture gas to accrete, to get bigger, what they call competitive accretion, that determines the probability of forming massive stars. And with that, I'm done. Thank you for your time.
Initially, you said that you expect stars to form along these shocks, but then you said that the shocks collide.
It's a mixture of everything. What you need is the turbulence has to be dissipated, because otherwise there is too much shear, you cannot really collapse. There's too much kinetic energy. And so that will happen in shocks. And then you need a very large density in order to collapse, to get in strong enough gravity. And that also it happens in shocks where the density is larger. Now, the typical shock is an oblique shock. Okay, so you dissipate the perpendicular component of the velocity, but there is still a parallel component that is there. So there's a lot of shear in the shock, in the post-shock gas. So there are two ways to kill the shear and form a star. Well, the thing is pretty random. It's got fluctuation on all scales, so that can easily be a kink here. And if there is a kink, this is a supersonic shear, you're going to stop it. But even better, if there is an intersection of shock, a collision of two shocks, then you have the gas flowing in one direction, and then it hits another shock, and it gets stuck. Well, if it's lucky, it's going to still move in that direction, but at some point it's going to meet another shock and get stuck. So you can go to sheets, into filaments, into cores, but not any further than that. But you can have everything. You can have a corrugation of a sheet that forms a star. You can have the intersection of two shocks in the filament, and a corrugation in the filament that forms a shock. Or you can have the intersection of filaments, or a filament with a sheet, and there you will form a star as well. That's quite a zoology of star forming places. Yeah?
At the end of the 18th century, there was some famous Royal Academy meeting where people were considering what were the major problems. And the conclusion was that the theoretical physics is done. There are just a couple of tiny things for which we know that quantum mechanics emerged later and then special relativity. So just for the people who were not at the meeting, I would like to tell that there are surely very intense debates for which there could be similar tendencies which emerged. For instance, for me, when it was very appealing that Paolo mentioned this Reynolds number of turbulence 10 to the 8. Well, we have 10 to the 4 with our numerical simulation. What is happening when we increase the Reynolds number? We need to study. Paolo also mentioned that there is this unknown beast of magnetized compressible turbulence. Some people claim that there is no self-similarity of this turbulence. For example, the degree of anisotropy of its changing. So this is
subsonic. That would be subsonic.
Subsonic and supersonic.
Well, supersonic has not been done.
Below the scale 0.1 parsec, there is a different regime of turbulence which is related to the formation of current sheets, ferromagnetic filaments. So there is a lot of things to discuss, and therefore the conference was really exciting. And also we need to understand, as Paolo said, the turbulence, I think, both from observational perspective and from theoretical perspective. We cannot just say, well, we understand something in incompressible unmagnetized turbulence, so we know turbulence, and
we can do some. Yeah, that was certainly not a criticism of my research, because I'm still very actively studying turbulence. Yes, the typical scale I wrote here before is the Kolmogorov dissipation scale in this dark cloud is even less probably than 10 to the 13 centimeter. So much smaller than the scale of interest here. So that's what I'm saying. Star formation is well within the inertial range of the turbulence that we observe. So that at least.
We expect to see these large velocity formations in
Yes, the cores, when you form a dense cores of, say, 0.1 parsec in size, significantly larger than this, we know that, first of all, if the picture I presented is correct, the turbulence is dissipated in the core. However, it's still observed. There are random velocity inside cores, what we call non-thermal motions. They are observed. They're not supersonic anymore. They're of the order of the thermal speed. But they're there. And in fact, there is no reason why the turbulence should stop at the thermal velocity. You will just have a different turbulent cascade within a core, a subsonic. Magnetic field is even more important here. So then standard theory of MHD turbulence may have a little better application here than in the larger environment. Yeah.
But this is an observation that is very important point, because when you get to the point where you go subsonic, you can't see everything out in the end, you have to see these kind of individual blobs that are like these things. But I don't know if we should distinguish. There is incompressible and compressible motions. And compressible motions can be dealt at a larger scale.
Just bring up another puzzle. I mean, one of the more interesting observational talks meeting was by Charlie Lahler, where he presented observations of a large scale region, 10 parsecs or more, 100 parsecs across, where the region doesn't seem to be very different. It's reasonably very dense nonlinear structures.
Actually, Charlie Lada didn't talk about the turbulence. He's now doing a millimeter line. He told me that the typical velocity, actually, he answered my question in the conference. The typical RMS velocity is of the order of a kilometer per second. So there is supersonic turbulence. And he showed a plot. He has measured the mass distribution of dense cores. And it's a distribution like this. Only that the turnover is not 0.2 solar masses, like for stars. These are dense cores and not stars. But of the order of one solar mass, if I remember correctly. Or two. One solar mass, I think. And two solar masses, yeah. And then he worked out what is the ambient pressure that you need. Same argument of my Bonnor-Eber turbulent pressure. And he finds a pressure that is in fact consistent with the dynamic pressure that you get from the turbulence that is observed in that region. In other words, that's the living proof of the argument I gave today. Yes.
So when you argue that these galaxies, you know, contain, you know, 100,000 genes masses.
Yes. Right? Yeah. There are. There are.
So what, you know, the turbulence, in fact, you know, as it dissipates, actually leads to the formation. So what I'm curious about is how could you imagine ever making these initial conditions in this scenario?
Which, the one that we observe?
Why didn't you make lots and lots of stars long before you assembled that rocket?
Because there is energy in the interstellar medium, no matter what gas phase you consider, cold gas, warm gas, everything is moving around. Everything is part of this turbulent cascade, essentially. And energy is injected. We are arguing if it is supernova explosion or some global instability, magnetic rotational instability in the galactic disk. But there is clearly energy on the large scale, the cascade on a small scale. And even if you imagine that the molecular cloud is formed from something that is more dilute and warmer, then cools down or goes thermally unstable and then gets denser, it doesn't matter because the initial condition is still highly turbulent.
But you're thinking of a large cloud. I mean, you're actually saying that the correct scale
yes.
is in solar masses at those conditions.
Yeah, but the point is that the kinetic energy is never of the turbulence. No matter what you look at, is never smaller than the gravitational energy, unless you look into dense regions, like in here. Then you can have locally something where the kinetic energy of the random motion is smaller of the gravitational energy.
Right, so that's what I'm saying, is your first shock.
Yes, your first shock will form the first stars. That's true.
So the turbulence is the end point of what people have done to create galaxies on more than one.
No. No. No, in cosmology it used to be like that up to maybe early 70s. And then it was understood that because even if there is an initial turbulence because of the expansion of the universe, that will decay very rapidly. And then you basically turbulence would not play a role for the formation of galaxies. Oh. I'm not, as I said, I'm not talking of primordial star formation. I'm talking of a galaxy, and then a galaxy like our galaxy is a disk. And if you look at the disk edge-on, it's rather flat, a few hundred parsec in this direction. And there is cold gas that tends to be organized in dense clouds. And this disk is highly turbulent. And in fact, we know that the RMS velocity in the vertical direction is, I don't know, 7 kilometers per second or so, maybe 10. And that's the reason why the disk has the thickness it has, because there is a balance between the vertical turbulent motion and the subgravity. We're arguing what is the origin of this turbulence. It's large-scale turbulence is the driving scale, you know, very large, the cascade into this type of turbulence. It's a turbulent cascade that starts on a scale like this. And there is, if you look at just globally, the energetics,
there are enough supernova
explosion to explain that, just by energetics. Then you want to look at the details. What happens? A supernova explodes, or a bunch of supernova explodes, they jet gas, it cools down and falls back. These are called galactic fountains. They're there, you can simulate, they're being simulated. Maybe they've been observed, I'm not sure. And there are the mechanisms. There are global disk instability that will also cause RMS velocity in random motions. Like if Ostreicher has worked on that, like magnetic rotational instability will give you that type of instability that originating spiral arms will also give you velocity fluctuations that can explain the origin of that energy. But generally speaking, there's plenty of energy sources. Just by global budget, you don't have an issue. There is no problem. Bruce?
Yeah, just reflecting on this black hole much, it seems that theoretical physics is fundamentally different from astronomy. Correct me if I'm wrong. Theoretical physics seems to be mathematically very complex, and somewhat simple. Because astronomy is mathematically very simple, so it makes me really physically very complex. So on the blackboard, you can write a lot of mathematics, and then you have a good place for theoretical physics to get here. But you cannot do astronomy on the blackboard. So to the extent that we're forced to have these equations, we're stuck in the 1950s.
Yes.
And it would be as if we astronomers invited theoretical physicists and forced you to talk about your work by showing movies. And so there's a complexity that follows getting at, which we see in our symposium, and we sort of understand, we get an intuitive feeling for what's happening by watching the simulation and seeing pictures like on the wall over there, where if you just hit by the complexity, all the different things happening all at once, it's very, very hard to start off from rather simple mathematics and from simple power law like this, which tell you almost nothing. There are many different ways to get these power laws. They tell you almost nothing about the intrinsic physics. And that's what we're facing.
Interested in changing subject? Thank you.